Welcome to the Jazz Piano School Podcast, episode number 6.
Play some killing jazz licks.
Jazz Piano School Podcast.
Learn jazz piano without all the guesswork.
Now, your host, Brendan Lowe.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Jazz Piano School Podcast, episode number 006. I'm super excited for this podcast, especially because we have our first guest coming on the podcast. And that guest is my good friend, but also a great person in jazz education, Dr. Samuel Griffith. And I met him in college, as you'll hear in the interview. And when I was in undergrad, and he was in undergrad, he was a sophomore, I was a freshman, and I met him on my dorm floor. And as you'll hear, you'll get to hear how we bonded. But we've been great friends ever since, so we get a little goofy. A little sarcastic at times, so just bear with that. But he's got just an immense amount. I've never met anyone with just so much information. Anything I need to know or have questions about, I can ask him, and he just knows it. You know, we just have this continuous joke. I just, you know, if he gives me some information, I'm just like, dude, how do you know this stuff? And he's just like, I know everything, okay? Just don't question it. So he really does. He's a great, great jazz trombone player. Knows about jazz more than anyone that I personally know. Just knows all about the history. Has done 10 years of schooling in jazz. Gone through, you know, obviously his undergrad, his master's, gotten his doctorate, and is just a great person to talk to about jazz and loves the music, loves playing it, and wants to help the scene and educate as many people as he can, and he's dedicated his life to it. So I thought he would be the perfect person to have on the show first because of those reasons, and also obviously because he's my good friend. So that little portion in the beginning of the podcast was a melodica that he was playing, which is, it's really cool. If you guys don't know what that is, it's a little piano that you actually blow into, so you can bring it on trips and everything. It's pretty portable. It's very light. You know, there's no electronics. It's all done by air, basically like an accordion almost. So you blow into it, and you can play the notes, and it actually makes sound. So that's what he was doing. You can obviously see that he has some skills. He was playing bebop lines with this little melodica, and his main instrument is trombone. So just some house cleaning items, guys. I just want to thank everyone who's given reviews so far. We got a couple more, which I'm really excited about, that have gone up on the iTunes store by Jazzy Joe 305. She said, great stuff, Jazzy Joe. Thanks so much. 5 stars. From Abby Red Shoes. I like that name a lot. Brendan Rocks. Excellent podcast. So interesting. Great information. Sounds like Brendan loves jazz and loves teaching others about jazz. So much fun to listen to. Abby Red Shoes, you're absolutely right. I do love jazz, and I love helping others and teaching it as well, because it's such a great style of music and it's very fun. So we got 2 more. Brendan's the best. 5 stars. These podcasts will be treasure trove for aspiring musicians. Brendan is a masterful teacher, and if jazzpianoschool.com harnesses even a fraction of his high in-person talent, it will be an amazing resource. That was one of my students. So Dave, thank you so much if you're listening. That's a great review. I really appreciate it. And then I got 1 more for you guys. Fantastic. 5 stars. Boring Man 117. Brendan is the best piano teacher that ever lived, with 10 exclamation marks. That was another one of my students. So, Parker, thank you so much. I appreciate that review. So before we get into the interview, our website is www.jazzpianoschool.com. And if you haven't been there, I'd strongly encourage you to do that. You can go and access all of our free lesson videos. All you need to do is sign up to become a free member of our website, and you'll get access to all the lesson videos. Along with that, you have all the notated music to the lesson videos, exercises, major scales, licks, everything that you can download and practice on your own. and you'll also be able to access the community forum in which you can ask questions. I will be answering questions on there for people, you know, who just have some general questions that they want to ask me. I'm also going to have other guests answering questions on the forum as well. So it's going to be a very helpful tool in the future. So www.jazzpianoschool.com. You can go there and get signed up for free today or whenever you'd like. So let's get into the interview. Without further ado, this is Dr. Samuel Griffith. All right, hey everyone, welcome back to the Jazz Piano School podcast. This is episode number 6, I believe. We have a very special guest today, Dr. Sam Griffith. So we went to school together. I'll just let you take it from here.
That's nice. Thank you. Yes, I'm originally from Monterey, California, which is a beautiful, beautiful location, and I'm very fortunate to grow up there and participate in the a lot of the jazz education programs sponsored by the Monterey Jazz Festival. They have a whole wealth of they have a lot of things they do for the young people in Monterey. They have a clinician program where clinicians come around to schools once a month. They do a great summer camp, as well as giving students the opportunity to volunteer in a bunch of events that happen, including the Monterey Jazz Festival itself, giving young people lots of great opportunity to learn jazz without actually having to ever paying for anything. So growing up there was an especially important thing for myself, just because it was such a nurturing environment. I met Brendan when I was doing my undergrad at the New School in New York.
Yes, you did.
Which was always...
My freshman year.
Yeah.
Your sophomore year.
That's correct. And that was a wonderful, fun time. Yeah, there. Learned a lot.
I think we bonded over football, didn't we?
We did. We did.
Not music.
And like some Dallas barbecue. That was what we bonded
That's
over.
That's right.
Football, Dallas barbecue.
That's right.
And since then I've gone on to... get a few more degrees in jazz. I'm currently doing the jazz ensembles out of UC Davis in California right now, which is a great time.
Do you want to say where you got your master's and doctorate?
I got my master's from California State University, Sacramento, and I got my doctorate from the University of Colorado at Boulder. Both great programs, both kind of on the rise, and kind of interesting... areas to live and study jazz.
Cool. How do you feel about going to a formal education for music for everyone listening? Maybe if they're, you know, thinking about going to a music school or...
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a very tricky question to answer because a lot of it depends on the student. One thing about pursuing music as a degree and music as a career is that you have to be very, very self-directed to succeed in both cases, especially in school, and then once you get out of school. It's a totally different degree than almost any other field because you have to spend a significant amount of your time, you know, in a practice room with no windows, just hours a day there, just practicing stuff. A lot of times practicing stuff that you don't necessarily want to practice. Hopefully most of the time it is, but it can very easily be the case that, you know, you're spending a lot of time doing things that aren't exactly fun. It's very unique, and it's not necessarily for everybody, but it can be very rewarding if you're able to spend that kind of time and do everything on your own.
What would be the contrasting route? Like, let's say someone, you know, didn't have the means to go to school or they didn't really want to. How would they go about pursuing a career in jazz?
If they weren't interested in academia, I would still suggest being involved some level at the college level, even if it's the community college level. A lot of cities have jam sessions or have some sort of like open mic night or something where musicians can connect and, you know, you can meet and hear other people. Other people can hear you. But any opportunity you can have to do that is very, very important to yourself, just because these are all like the experiences you want and need to succeed in music. You know, you need people to hear you. You need to hear other people. You need to find musicians that work well with you and vice versa. Even just playing like on a community college jazz band or taking some like community college music courses, that those might offer you the opportunity to find musicians that are in a similar situation as yourself, which is definitely ideal for pursuing music and also, you know, kind of establishing a network of musicians. Mm. It really comes down to networking.
Mm. So just kind of putting yourself out there, going out to jam sessions, making connections, basically.
Yep.
And would you say ultimately that's the leading factor, or one of the leading factors in like making it, or like getting gigs, getting, you know, just availability to play out at places?
Yeah, I would say all of the above. Getting gigs is always the trickiest because that requires a different, slightly different skill set. There's a little more like marketing and kind of haggling with club owners. Or
let's talk about that for a second. So, like, how would people? What do you think the best way to go about doing that is for them?
I think being honest. You know, one thing about any club owner, any coffee shop owner, any bar owner, any venue owner is they get a lot of requests from people to play, and they can probably smell people. They can probably figure out who's...
I'm not editing that out.
You are going to edit that out. Who's going to be sincere in their requests versus who is just kind of like trying to promote themselves as something they might not be. So when you're going through that process, I think the more honest you can be and sincere, I think it'll help you in the long run. Because these people, like I said, see, you know, probably hundreds of musicians who are trying to play at these venues.
Mm.
You know, have little time to deal with anything that seems like it might be fake.
Okay. So how do you go about doing that then? Should people contact the owners? Should they send out press kits? Or like in your experience, what do you think the best way is to handle that?
I think all of the above. I like to say, for me, I think it's attempting to establish some level of connection or rapport with the club owner.
Mm.
I think all my friends that are successful in getting gigs usually have a great relationship with the person who books the events or the owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're not necessarily reliant on these typical kind of promotional materials.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about establishing some kind of relationship there and then just making sure you don't screw it up.
Cool. Let's get into some piano specifics. So you know how to play piano.
I do.
Right?
I do.
Pretty well.
Not as good as you.
Well, I mean, that's a given, so... I definitely can't play trombone as well as you can play piano, though.
I don't know.
So did you have to... Did they make you learn piano, or did you just practice it on your own? In school, you know, in college.
In college, yeah. Piano, I think, is a required course for most music majors and most jazz majors. Usually there's a kind of basic piano skills component, and mm-hmm. then also some, you know, a semester or two of jazz piano. All of which is completely invaluable as a musician, because knowing the piano, being able to play the piano, is a skill that will help you in all levels of your musical career throughout your entire life. Whether it's arranging and composing songs, whether it's like playing through chord progressions, or if you're a composer, figuring out like, new chord progressions, whether it's teaching lessons, you know, it doesn't even matter what instrument you're teaching. If you can play chords behind them or play with them on piano, it gives them a little different musical experience than if you're just, you know, matching them on your instrument. So I think the piano is definitely probably the most important tool you can have as a musician.
For the people who are just starting out, when you were first starting out, how did you make progress? I mean, what were some of the things that helped you progress on the piano the most in the beginning?
Going slow. I know that sounds goofy, but
no, not at all.
With all of it, my piano class was a combination of both attempting to learn technique and also learning some basic chord voicings. And I know sitting in the practice room, it was all about going slow and being very deliberate in how I was practicing everything was the definitely the best, especially as I was given more kind of advanced things, some of those like Bach inventions and things where hands are moving at different times.
You had to play those?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we had to learn one. I think it was two. I think it was we had to learn one every 8 weeks or something.
Mm-hmm. And so those helped you just technically and just with the coordination and everything like mm-hmm. that?
Yep.
So what would you recommend besides that? What other things were you doing in the practice room? Were you practicing specific?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going through the circle of fifths and practicing open piano voicings and closed piano voicings.
Mm. So for the people listening, can you describe what you mean by that, open and closed voicings?
Open voicings are where the chords are kind of equally spread out among both hands. Typically in the left hand, you would have the root and third or root and seventh. And then in the right hand, you would have the other remaining notes of the chord. Usually either the fifth, the ninth, and then either the seventh or third, depending on what you used in your left hand. The closed voicings where you just have the bass note in the left hand and then the other chord tones in the right hand. So you might have the root in the left hand and then 3, 5, 7, 9 in the right hand.
So you're practicing open and closed voicings. So
yeah,
going through
the circle of fifths. Mm-hmm. And then also we'd be required to like kind of sight read a new tune each week.
Mm.
So it'd be kind of going through a jazz fake book, opening up to a random page and trying to play through it, always trying to utilize good voice leading.
Mm.
I think that's a lot of the where going slow really helps, is figuring out what is the least amount of movement I can do to connect these chords while not.
Mm-hmm. One of my students last week, or a couple weeks ago actually, he sounds great. He sounds great all the time, you know, but he just wasn't, he's going to, I think it's the, what's that? The one of the jazz camps that Eric Reed was supposed to be at that showed me. San Diego one, I believe. Anyway, he's going there, but he just wasn't used to playing new tunes, you know, which was a requirement. So one of the things we were working on actually is just opening up, like you said, to a random tune and playing it. And so he seems to be getting a lot out of that just because he's just doing what you said, you know, voice leading the chords and things like that. So you obviously found that it helped you, right, to do that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. And for me, it was definitely all about like going slow and just being very deliberate. Mm-hmm. And that the more you do it, the easier it gets. So you start establishing these kind of connections that happen in a lot of tunes or a lot of progressions, and then it all starts clicking.
Gotcha. Let's talk about interaction or combo playing, or because you're a trombone player, you're obviously not a pianist. So when you're playing in a group, what types of things are you looking from the pianist to do behind you when you're soloing, when you're playing the melody, just in all sort of aspects?
Sure. That's a pretty tricky and pretty comprehensive question, because there's a ton of things that should happen or ideally would happen with a pianist behind any soloist during the course of a jazz song. The first thing is what do they do behind the melody? You know, jazz melodies are very diverse. There's lots of different types of melodies, and that requires some different comping ideas that you need to be aware of. There are tunes like Tune Up, the great little 16-bar jazz tune that's credited to Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a very like long kind of like legato melody that's, you know, a lot of like half notes and whole notes. And there's obviously a lot of space in a song like that for the pianist to kind of fill in behind. But that's, you know, then there's other songs such as like Donna Lee,
mm-hmm.
or Confirmation, where the melody's very active, the bebop lines, there's a lot happening. In those cases, the pianist really has to pick and choose spaces that are a little more deliberate than perhaps on a song that's mentioned, like Tune Up. So when I'm listening to a pianist for the first time, that's the first thing I listen to, is how is he interpreting the melody? because a lot of times he won't be playing the melody, but where is he choosing to play? What, you know, where is he filling in the space? Those kind of ideas. Mm.
So they can interfere with the melody that you guys are playing, or if you're playing by yourself the melody, then it's pretty easy for them to interfere with what you're doing if they're not careful.
Oh yeah. Happens all the time.
All the time. There you go.
Yeah. And then during solos, I'm looking for something similar. You know, they can be much more active typically. Because it's a different kind of environment than when playing the melody. But I'm trying to make sure they don't interfere, that they're listening to everything around them, especially the drums and the bass. that they're not getting too far away from what's written or what the soloist is intending. I know pianists are typically pretty bright guys and have a whole wealth of things they can do at their disposal. So it's very easy for them just to kind of reharmonize chords right on the spot.
Get carried away.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah, it's not always the most appropriate thing. Yeah. The other thing that a lot of pianists, I think, forget about or kind of settle into early on that's a little goofy is range. They become comfortable playing chords like in a specific area of the keyboard just because that's where they practice it.
Mm.
But I think there's a lot to be said if the pianist can kind of experiment with different areas of the range and play things that are a little higher or maybe a little lower to kind of complement each soloist. I'm a trombone player, so everything I play is going to be no more than like an octave above middle C and then a lot below middle C. So there's all these sounds, you know, kind of in the upper end of the piano that can be utilized that'll be like a nice complement to what I'm doing instead of being in the same range.
Right. That's one of the things I noticed too. When I was studying with Eric Reed and just listening to him on recordings, you know, is the range variation. Because a lot of pianists, like you said, you'll just hear right in the dead center of the piano. It just doesn't give much texture variation. But, you know, he's hitting bass notes. He's going up high, just listening really well.
Yeah.
Cool.
I keep getting on that guy.
Yeah.
No, it is it's a goofy thing that a lot of pianists do. But it can be easily fixed as soon as you just, you know.
As you're conscious of it.
Yeah, you got 88 keys. Like I said, there's like basic rules, you know, you can always adhere to, too, with that. Because guitar, I think, is in a similar range to piano. So that's an area where playing up sounds good. If it's like an alto saxophone or trumpet, usually that middle range is just fine. And then tenor saxophone, they can be all over the map. So it's another one where you kind of have to be.
Now, is the range something you're... sorry, I meant to interrupt. Is it something you're conscious of when the pianist is comping behind you? I saw there's a YouTube video of Wynton. They're rehearsing at Ronnie Scott's, the club in London. And he stops playing and yells at, like, Dan Nimmer, I think. Not yells, but it's just like, hey, get out of that range. He's like, you gotta move your range. So, like, are you aware of if you're playing in a certain range and a pianist is in the same range as you, do you feel like that's conflicting at some times? Or
I will say, in the heat of battle, I'm not sure I'm as aware of it. I'm more aware of it when I've kind of like removed myself and I'm just kind of like in like deep listening, like analyzing the group as they're playing.
Because
usually when you get 3 or 4 minutes in, if things are somewhat stale or it sounds like things haven't like grown or developed, it is like one of the components that's happening. You know, it's usually there's not enough like shift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure... You can imagine with any musical thing, if you just stuck to, you know, like 36 notes, like a 36 note range, you know, that would start to sound the same after a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing, you know, speaking of playing behind solos, that I noticed too, that it's like a very easy fix that some pianists don't necessarily do, is conceptualizing comping as like a combination of short or long sounds, and that switching up whatever it is you're emphasizing, like on the bridge. So if you're comping a song and you're mostly using like long chords or longer sounds, when it gets to the bridge, do like short ideas or like vice versa. It's a great way to kind of bring out the importance of the bridge, and then also kind of like help cue the musicians in case they're getting lost or having trouble keeping the form, that, you know, every time they start to hear these kind of short sounds, it really does kind of help direct them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's mm-hmm. good.
Yeah. Adding contrast.
Yeah.
Right? Contrast to the different yeah. sections of the piece.
Yeah. And like I said, you're just kind of like programming it in by just saying, like, on the bridge, I'm just going to do short sounds.
Mm.
And, you know, eventually like, it'll grow out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But just kind of like having that kind of map or blueprint in your brain will.
Mm-hmm. So when people are comping, then let's say they're changing up their textures, they're aware of that. How should they be listening to the band? How should a pianist be listening to the band for interaction? Should they be focused on the soloist, the drummer? Who should they interact with? You know, what would a process be? You know, everyone's like, oh, you got to interact more, but like, how do you actually go about doing that?
Yeah, that's one of the trickiest things to do, and it's usually like very much overdone by everybody in the rhythm section.
Mm. I agree.
You know, because a lot of people think that interaction is like the most important thing, or is this thing that like has to be done. Mm. So what you get is you get a horn player soloing, and the pianist interacting with them,
mm-hmm.
the drummer interacting with them, the bass player interacting with them,
mm-hmm.
and like everything else like seems to be sacrificed at the sake of the interacting with the soloist, you know, groove, every time,
mm-hmm.
music, everything. Like, yeah. Everything.
Music, that's right.
There's some kind of basic like ways to kind of structure everything that make a lot of sense. And then, you know, as if the soloist is soloing longer and longer, then maybe you become more and more interactive. But I think a good general rule is that the first chorus of any solo, you should think about comping similar to how you comp behind the melody.
Mm.
You know, so as I mentioned before, if you're playing a song where the melody is very kind of melodic or drawn out or has a lot of long notes.
You can keep going.
Yeah, a lot of long notes, then you know, comp in a similar way. If it's one of these melodies, it's a lot of bebop lines, and you're doing shorter ideas or kind of filling in the holes, maybe continue with that trend. The logic behind this is that most great soloists, especially early in their solos, are still conceptualizing the melody in what they're trying to play. So if they're thinking about the melody and trying to base their ideas off the melody,
mm.
and you're comping like the melody, then there should be this kind of harmonious thing that happens where everyone's kind of on the same page, and like I said, it's not necessarily interaction, but we're all focused on the melody. Then as the soloist continues soloing, you can start to get away from that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The way it was taught to me is that kind of the next level of interaction is trying to sync up what you do with the snare drum or the left hand of the drummer.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of levels to kind of interaction, and if you're playing ideas that the drummer can kind of set up or fill with, or if he's doing all these fills and you kind of do hits with him, it kind of creates this cohesion in the rhythm section that the soloist can solo on top of.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So, yeah. Like I said, there's always a little level of interaction, but it seems like if you can establish that in the rhythm section first, it lets the horn player do whatever they want to do. And the further he keeps going, the longer he solos, then maybe it gradually becomes a little more interactive with him.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, it's more of like the rhythm section's like the nice, like, you know, hotel pillow that he can, like, sleep on.
Mm. I like nice hotel pillows.
Yeah, you do.
I remember...
I have an awful pillow.
What?
I have an awful pillow. My neck hurts every morning. I like my head bashes against the wall. It's just falling apart.
So that's just like a overreactive rhythm section right there.
It is.
Just feels stiff in the morning. Your head feels terrible.
It is.
I remember, it's like, I think it's like a wave almost. You know, it's like when you first start out, you're not playing much. I think in all like comping aspects, and because you're still learning a little bit, but actually it's not that bad, you know, because you're just playing so simply mm-hmm. that it works out. And then when I got to college, I was just trying to play the hippest stuff and just putting way too much in. And even now, like, you know, 8 years out of college, I'm definitely better, but, you know, I can still feel myself wanting to throw things in there, but I definitely have taken a more laid back and supportive approach through maturity. rather than, you know, trying to just over, you know, interact with the drummer, the bass player, what are you doing, you know? And then, you know, now I just feel like laying down the harmonies, really, so the, and listening to the soloist.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's it.
What would you say, what's a good, soloing can be daunting, you know, improvising, learning how to improvise. For someone who's beginning to improvise, and maybe you can do, you know, beginning, intermediate, advanced, what are some good approaches to start to integrate jazz language into your playing, or, you know, your path that they should take?
It's very challenging. I maintain the viewpoint that jazz is a language, and that, you know, if you're learning a new language, you have to spend time, you know, like learning the words, and then turn the words into sentences, and then eventually being able to just, you know, freely, like, speak the language. And I definitely feel it's the same way with jazz. Mm. I know a lot of people try to always do, like, too much, especially early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it comes from just, like, coming up with, like, little short sentences, little short ideas that you can play or that you can say. One of the best ways, I think, for that to happen is to, you know, for each chord or for each chord sequence, just pick out, like, a few notes. You know, like 3 or 4 notes. And the piano's lucky because, you know, you can do it in several different octaves. You know, mm-hmm. this is much more frustrating for trombone and trumpet players who, you know, might only be able to do ideas in 2 octaves. Mm-hmm. But just pick out a few notes for each chord and just come up with little ideas that make sense or, like, little sentences. And then as those become more comfortable or you know, feel good there, then, like, add a few more notes. You know, there are tons of books that do a great job of kind of walking through, like, jazz theory and jazz harmonies. I'm sure some of the videos here at Jazz Piano School.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll also cover
throwing that little marketing in there. I like that. Yeah. Sneaking it in.
Oh, yeah.
www.jazzpianoschool.com.
Those are, like, a great starting point to have, like, these little ideas, and that as you become more comfortable with those, then you, like, want to form, like, bigger sentences, just like, you know, you were learning a language. I think that's probably the easiest way to go. You know, the I think it's just invaluable is listening to as much as you can, finding transcriptions of pianists, doing transcriptions, and playing along with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the big, like, gaps that happens in a lot of jazz education, especially, like, self-directed jazz education, is the kind of neglecting listening as much as you need to. You know, it's very easy to say, like, you listen to jazz and that you listen to it, but just like a language, like, you have to be speaking it, like, all the time. You have to hear people speak it, you mm-hmm. know? And if you don't, like, hear this and you know, hear all the nuances and you know, how they create ideas, how long are their ideas, are they short ideas, where, like, in the bar do they create these ideas, all these kind of, like, factors, it'll never really, like, work its way into your own playing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the other area that if you want to play jazz, you have to start. And, you know, there's so many great resources, too, that can be used, you know, where you're just, like, playing along with somebody that already, like, knows the language.
Mm-hmm.
That'll help immensely.
I don't know what that was. Having some fun.
There's, like,
upstairs.
A weird, like, it sounds like the dental saw thing that we hear up there.
That's what goes on upstairs.
It could be Dexter.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it was Hal Galper. He was doing a masterclass, and he said, if your ear can't hear it, right, then you're not going to be able to play it, really. So, so definitely listening. Like, the more you take it in and hear it, then it's going to be able to translate through yourself and then into your instrument. Cool. So what about, I'll ask you just a couple more questions. Once you get to a certain level, I mean, every musician experiences plateauing. What kind of ways, or how have you experienced that? And then how would you recommend going about breaking through those plateaus or making continual progress on the instrument?
Yeah, that is a tricky question, because the plateauing, I think, like, always happens, and sometimes it requires just some sort of new breakthrough, like, for the performer.
Hmm.
If you can always, like, take yourself outside of jazz and just look at, like, what's happening musically, that'll usually provide you some pretty good clues as to what you can do to get better or what you can do to kind of push yourself to the next level. So what I mean by that is that if you've spent a lot of time figuring out, like, harmony and playing through 2-5-1 progressions, and you can play through chord progressions, like, no problem, but you kind of feel like you're, like, stuck there, or that, you know, you're having a hard time kind of, like, getting to the next level, look at everything you do. Are you utilizing triplets? Are you utilizing double time? Have you started utilizing substitutions, especially for, like, the dominant chords? Mm. Like you should come up with some kind of checklist to hear, like, what is it you're doing and what are you not doing? Are you playing phrases that are, like, 1 bar, 2 bar? You know, maybe push yourself to doing, like, 8 bar phrases. Push yourself to use nothing but triplets. Or, you know, some other crazy, like, 5 tuplets or something. Are you playing everything? Is it all, like, too in? You know, are you playing, like, everything too perfectly and too cleanly?
Mm-hmm.
Should you be a little more, you know, adventuresome chromatically? I think Herbie Hancock has to be the absolute best at, like, overcoming, like, plateaus. Because it seems like there's different levels of his career where he's kind of, like, mastered whatever's happening, but yet he always seems to go, like, to a new level. Mm. And a lot of it is because he kind of continues to explore, you know, the jazz unknown. You know, and if you listen to, like, his voicings, like, nowadays, like, who knows what the snot is happening in those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's just, like, the level, like, where he's, like, progressed to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I think he's always kind of pushing himself and always, like, exploring, like, new sounds. And I know a lot of times that's the only way to, like, overcome plateaus is figuring out, like, where you're at now and what can you add in that'll, you know, what can you practice to get out of your comfort zone, I guess.
Mm.
I think is the best way.
Definitely. All right, I'm going to ask you some random questions here now. How do you feel about licks?
Licks are an invaluable resource to the beginning jazz musician because it allows you to connect to the jazz language. The only problem with licks is that if you're too obsessed with them, 3 or 4 years down the road, that might be all you have. So you have to think of, like, licks as, like, a gateway kind of into learning jazz vocabulary. But you have to make sure that you're also practicing things in a creative manner, too, so that you have a wide-ranging repertoire.
Mm, well said. Why don't you give us three... I know this is going to be really tough. 3 to 5 albums, maybe, that you think would be helpful for a pianist listening to this podcast. Well, anyone, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
You can say pianist.
No, to anyone. To anyone. But let's say, you know, if someone who's playing piano, because I'm assuming the majority of my listeners are going to be a pianist, you know, for them to progress, they don't have to listen to pianists, but just, you know, what albums would you recommend?
Okay.
I guess that's a
Okay. 1 second. Well, all right. So there's a Lester Young Trio album from 1938 or 1939, I think. I might have totally botched that the year. But this album features Nat King Cole and Buddy Rich. Nat King Cole is frequently overlooked in regards to learning the history of jazz piano, but he's the one of the first guys to really master accompanying, especially modern accompaniment. And he was definitely a big inspiration to guys who'd come later, like Bill Evans and such. And so I think hearing what he does in that context, because there's no bass playing behind the soloist, and this is kind of when the idea of the jazz soloist and playing tunes with solos was becoming more and more popular. I think that's a great album to kind of reference and listen for ideas and just have a good idea for, like, where jazz accompaniment started. in its kind of like modern context. I'm not going to give a specific album, but I think another great set of albums to listen to are any of the Miles Davis First Quintet albums with Red Garland. Red Garland had a very systematic approach to accompaniment. I think he'd like always play on like the end of two or the end of four or something, but it was a very consistent kind of idea that totally gelled with the rhythm section and also created a good kind of foundation for the soloist to solo over. You know, it'd be a good person to listen to for what we were talking about before with interaction, because he doesn't necessarily get anybody's way. I'm not going to give it a third album either, but I will say that listening to guys that are great accompanists, Larry Willis, he was a Roy Hargrove's piano player for a long time. He's on some of Roy's albums from the late 90s, early 2000s. He's great behind soloists because he finds great ways of playing behind them without getting in their way. And then also Kenny Barron is another guy too that's just unbelievable because of how subtle he can be while still playing very interesting stuff.
All right, so I guess we're coming down to the end here. I'm just going to ask you one more question, and I'll let you be on your way. Why don't you give us some general insight to someone just starting out or someone that may be advanced? You know, just, I don't know, something that people can take away, the listeners can take away, some sort of concept or any sort of insight into progressing in this music. I want to hear the words of wisdom from Sam Griffith, from Dr. Samuel Griffith on jazz.
Yeah, there's
too many.
You know, there are thousands and thousands of people that want to be jazz musicians and that are jazz musicians and are all great. And that one of the hardest things to do is to establish your own artistic identity. And the only way I think to really truly do that is to make sure that you listen to everything you possibly can and, you know, take what you can from everything. Otherwise, if you kind of limit yourself or only kind of pick and choose from one thing, I think it limits like what you can do or what you could be, if that makes any sense. So as you're listening to things, make sure you always take time to kind of explore the music and listen to guys that, you know, you might have zero interest at all in ever actually sounding like or playing like, but for the most part, there's a reason that a lot of these people are famous. You know, musicians like Cecil Taylor, who's a free jazz musician, and a lot of people feel that he's his improvisations are basically like 20th century classical piano pieces that he is just improvising like on the spot. A lot of times, some musicians don't, you know, totally dig this, but there is like some merit there. There is something there, you know, that he's doing. So trying to find these things, I think, will help, you know, help your music and help you establish your own artistic identity.
Great. Great. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you doing this.
No problem.
So how do people get in contact with you if they want to ask you questions or hire you? Or
They can go to my website, samuelgriffith.com.
Okay, and they can email you there and That's stuff correct. Like that? That's great, correct. Great. Well, thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too.
All right, that was a great interview. I loved interviewing him. Perfect person to be the first guest on the podcast. Lots of great information. I was learning so much from him, and I'm going to employ a lot of the concepts and practice techniques, things he was talking about in my playing as well. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. As always, guys, if you could leave me a review, I'd really, really appreciate it. I'm trying to get out to as many people as possible and spread the word, and your reviews help so much for people who are stumbling across the podcast. They see a good 5-star review, then they can start listening and start learning from the knowledge just like you are. Again, if you could like the Facebook page, I'd really appreciate it too. And plus, you'll get a lot of free content, voicings, techniques, practice, exercises, behind-the-scenes look. I'm going to be in Reno next week playing at the festival. You'll get a lot of looks behind the scenes at Reno. So it's just a lot of more personal insight into my life and the background behind Jazz Piano School. So as always, guys, thank you so much. Until next time, happy practicing.